Okay, thank you for the introduction, Egon, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to give this talk and to be here at the Fields for the duration of the program. It's been a great time. So this is a continuation of the last talk in some sense. I've been told that I certainly need to review what's going on and assume you've forgotten most of the things over the lunch period. So I will start out by with some review. This is a collaboration with Isabel, Danielle, and Asia, who are all here, and the title is now cubical for testides, not equivalent like before. So the outline is an introduction of what is a twistoid again, some review, and then really get into a little bit more detail for two different groups. One group where the quotient will give you an orientable manifold, and one group where the quotient will give you something that's not orientable. And I'll review what this notation of the groups is as we get to those groups. Okay. So let's see if we can remember what is a twistoid. So you start with a tessellation of Euclidean space, underlying tessellation U. And for us, we're going to consider the tessellation by cubes. And you pick some subgroup of automorphisms of this tessellation, and we want them to be fixed point free. So you have a fixed point free crystallographic group G, which is a subgroup of your automorphism group of the tessellation. In the next talk, Max will consider some groups that don't have this last property, so groups where you allow fixed points, but we want these things to be normal manifolds when we take the quotient. So what we'll do is we'll take the quotient of the tessellation by this group G by looking at orbits under the action of the group. All right. So I'll give the example that Isabel gave already, the normal torus. You start out with the tessellation of Euclidean 2 space by squares, and you pick some fixed point free group of translations. Then you can look at the orbits of the vertices, edges, and squares under the action of this group, and you get things that we'll call vertices, edges, and squares of our twistoid. And in terms of the topology, the quotient will always give us a flat Riemannian manifold. And this one, in the nice picture with the same coloring, gives you a torus with far more squares than I drew, but it's nicer with more squares. And this is a three-twistoid. So maps on the Klein bottle and on the torus are three-twistoids, and we want to consider four-twistoids for this talk. So instead of the tessellation by two-space by squares, we need to look at the tessellation of three-space by cubes and consider symmetries of this. What do we need to do is find a fixed-point-free subgroup of the symmetry group of this lattice. And we'll always consider the lattice that has an origin at a vertex and integer lengths here. So just fix the size and the location of the lattice. In the last talk, we saw the symmetry group of this. It's the Coxeter group 434. So you need to figure out how to put some sort of fixed point free crystallographic group into this tessellation so that it is a subgroup of this Coxeter group. That's the main idea. And then once we do that, we want to understand what are the possible symmetries, what are the automorphisms of this quotient. And how we do that is you consider automorphisms of the underlying tessellation. So say you have an automorphism H of your underlying tessellation by cubes. You want it to be compatible with the quotient. Otherwise, things don't make sense. So what do I mean by compatible with the quotient? Well, just a little bit of algebra. It means that your automorphism of the tessellation has to normalize the group you're taking the quotient by. And now there's two different things from Isabel's talk. The group of symmetries of the twistoid, which is really a subgroup of the automorphism group of the tessellation, and then the quotient gives you the automorphisms of the twistoid. It's sometimes convenient to think in this regard because then you can identify what these symmetries really are. So you have translations, you have rotations, reflections. Once you go down into the quotient, you lose some of that structure. We'll see, especially in the non-orientable case, things really get messy down in here, but you can still understand what's going on up here. Okay. All right, so that's my quick review. Now I want to get a little bit more in detail for one group. So here is the group in Conway's notation, 3, 3, 3, 1 third plus, 1 third plus, 1 third plus. And I don't expect you remember from Isabel's talk what this is. It went by pretty quickly. This is a group generated by three screw motions, all in the same direction, all parallel axes. And in fact, you only need two of them to generate the third. And they all have the same translational component. So if you like, you can just pick a blue screw motion, or what we've been calling a twist, and a green screw motion parallel with the same translational component. That generates your group. It gives you a nice fundamental region, which is glued as follows. If you cut it horizontally, it looks like a torus. So the walls of this hexagonal prism are all glued by translation, front to back, here to there, there to there, all by translation. And the bottom and the top are glued using this blue screw motion, this blue one-third, threefold twist, if you like. So this flag here goes to that flag there. Okay. If you didn't believe me, you only need two of them. You can generate the third. And then the question becomes, once you have this fundamental region, once you know what the generators of your group are, how could you arrange this into the cubical lattice so that this group really is a subgroup of automorphisms of your tessellation? So that's what you have to keep in mind, trying to fix this hexagonal prism into the cubical lattice in some nice way. And that's pretty restrictive to do. Okay, in the point group of this automorphisms of 434, which Agon called the special group, Isabel called the stabilizer, it has a lot of different names. It's just the symmetries of your tessellation mod the translational, the normal translational subgroup. You don't have very many options for threefold things. So the symmetry group, the point group here, is the octahedral group. It's just the symmetries of one cube. So if you like, you can think of every symmetry of the tessellation as determined first by where you move one cube to, and then the symmetry of that cube that you move the first one to. So it's a translation and just a symmetry of the cube. And the only symmetries of a cube are these threefold rotations along the diagonal, main diagonal of the cube. So it's really restrictive. Everything will have to be a translation times some threefold rotation through the main diagonal of the cube. Everything that is coming from these threefold twists. All right. So like I just said, that tells you basically where the axes of your twists have to go. Tells you the orientation of this hexagonal prism into your cubical lattice, if you like. It's always going to go, I have this one on the table, through this direction, the 1-1-1 direction. Here's the direction projected onto the board. You're looking through the main diagonal of the cube. You can really see the threefold rotation here. This is very symmetric, threefold symmetric. So all of our generators, the threefold screw motions, threefold twists, are parallel to this direction, straight through the main diagonal of the cube. But something is a little bit more complicated than this. So you certainly have threefold twists whose axis go through the main diagonals of cubes, but you have more as well. And to see that, I need more cubes. So here's some more cubes. Same projection, same from 1-1-1 projection. And now I'm going to make some of the cubes hollow. And you see, it's not the best picture, but you see you have a regular triangular tessellation of the plane in this projection. So not only do you have, that's a clearer picture, not only do you have these twists that can be aligned with the main diagonals of cubes, but you also have threefold symmetry, which is in the center of these triangles in this projection. And it's a little hard to see. Sometimes I can do it. There is a threefold symmetry here, and I'll try to illustrate that with the next slide. It's going to be through the Petri motion of, can you see this? The Petri motion of the cubical lattice. So I'm going to take these three cubes and try to rotate them through this axis with a twist, threefold twist up. And I didn't want to try to draw this on the computer, so this is just a photo. So here's one, two, three. So if you make this twist three times, you get a translation in the 1-1-1 direction. And I think if you play them back and forth, you can really see it's a twist. You can really see it's threefold, and it's a symmetry of the lattice. And it's fun to just do this. I won't do it for too much longer. Okay. But you do have an extra type of symmetry there. It's not a symmetry of any given cube, but it's a symmetry of the lattice itself. Okay. All right, so now we have a really good idea about how we can place this fundamental region into the cubical lattice. We have to take this hexagonal prism. It's going to go into the direction, so when you look at it, you see this regular triangular tessellation. And we know that the twists are either at vertices or at centers of triangles in this tessellation. Okay. In fact, we know a little bit more, and this is subtle, slightly subtle, is that the height of the twist is going to be somewhat determined by where you place the axis. Somewhat determined, determining quotes. So for example, if you place your twist through the main diagonal of the cube, well then, I guess I could try to stack it on top of each other. You know that the height of the transitional component has to be a full integer multiple of the main diagonal of the cube. Right, so you can take this one and threefold twist it into that one, but you can't go in anything that's not the integer multiple of root 3. On the other hand, if you put something there, like this guy, you can. So this is something that is shifted up by 1/3 the square root of 3. And then if I put another one on there, like you saw in the picture, you can go something that's 2/3 the square root of 3 up. So knowing where the twist goes in this projection tells you something about the actual height of the fundamental region. And even more, this plus or minus 1 mod 3, if you have something that's 1 mod 3, basically it'll partition the triangles of this tessellation into, say, the ones that are of this orientation, the vertical triangles, if you like, I don't know what that means, and the other ones. And these, if you have something in a vertical triangle, then all of your twists will be in a vertical triangle, because this will determine whether or not your k is plus or minus 1 mod 3, basically. It's a left-handed or a right-handed Petri motion, if you like. So let's go ahead and do it. Let's see an example. Since the one I had was through the Petri motion, I will pick my first twist and put it in a Petri motion here. We have some flexibility about where we put the origin. So in the cubical lattice, you can label the origin wherever you like. So let's just think that the origin is really close to the first twist that you place in. All you have to do now is place another twist. We know because k is determined up to mod 3, it has to be in another similar-looking triangle. Put it anywhere you like. And from there, these two twists generate your group. So two twists give you the third one, and then so on. And there's your fundamental region, at least the projection of it. You don't know the height of it yet. Okay. So there's the projection of your fundamental region into this tessellation by triangles. So we have basically two parameters to determine everything we need to know about this twistoid. One of them is the height of the fundamental region, k. And really that height, well, its height is k times the square root of 3 over 3, but k tells you the height. That height actually determines what type of triangle the first twist is in. And then you just need to know how to get to from one twist to the next. So you have some vector a, b, which we'll use in this canonical basis for 1, 1, 2. So this would be A, B is 1, 2. Just from here to there. And it tells you how to get to the second twist, and that tells you everything you need to know about the group. Defines the fundamental region completely. Okay, start the picture. It's not so obvious to see that this is a normal way of building a map, the way everything's glued together, but I'm going to cut and paste it in a nice way. So now this is a normal-looking map on the torus, defined by this triangular tessellation. And similar to Isabel's talk, symmetries of this map will give you some ideas about symmetries of the twistoids. So for example, if this map is regular, then you can have some extra automorphisms of your twistoid. Okay. So this is another fundamental region projected down. Like, so symmetries. What do we have? If you're really paying a lot of attention and fast, you can count the flags. We have 48 times k, where k is the integer part of root 3 over 3 in the height of the fundamental region, times a squared plus b squared plus ab flags. So we have a lot of flags, and it depends, grows depending on the size of the fundamental region in this projection. It's big. Every time, let's see if I can do this. The bottom of the fundamental region is glued to the top of the fundamental region by a threefold twist. So if you start at some point and start translating up, the first time you get to identity is when you go up 3k times. So the height, I don't know how far back you have to go to get a fundamental region. The height was here is k. So if you start going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to k, the first time you get identity is at 3k. So you have these 3k automorphisms of the twistoid. Oh, I went past it. Which then tells you that the number of flag orbits is at most that number of flags divided by 3k. So we have a bound, at least, on the number of flag orbits. Unfortunately, it's still dependent on A and B. So when you put your two twists far apart, you have unbounded number of flag orbits. Then, in theory, from the symmetries of the map in the projection, you should be able to get lots of symmetries. Unfortunately, you don't. So if the map in the projection is regular, you only get another order of two. So you can cut the number of flag orbits by half, in this case, the example that I'm doing, or by four, in the case where the twists were through the main diagonals of the cube. So you get things that are symmetric, but as A and B get big, unbounded number of flag orbits. Let's do some small examples. I like to see the degenerate ones, so if you don't care about polytopality, you can make the height really small, so the height is just one-third of the way up a cube. A and B are as close together as you can get in this tessellation, and you get something which has one vertex, three edges, three squares, one cube. Everything is on one vertex, so it should be in quotes. But you still have four flag orbits, so even this small is not that symmetric. The smallest polytopal example in terms of flags is this one that I have built in front of me. It has, I forget how many flags, but I didn't write that, but it has 24 flag orbits. There's one other case which has fewer flag orbits, but it has more flags, which is that instead of going through a Petri motion, you make your twist through the diagonal of a cube. And you can make it as tall as you want, as long as it's through the diagonal of the cube, your twists. Okay, so 12 flag orbits, polytopal things. Okay. All right, so that's the orientable case, some twistoids. What goes on in the group 3, 3, 3, 1 third plus, 1 third plus, 1 third plus? So let's just do a little bit before I stop on something non-orientable, because things are interesting in this case. So here's the group 2, 2 star, 1 half plus, 1 half plus, 1 half plus. And how is it generated? It's generated by two twofold twists. So here's a red twofold twist, red half turn plus a translation, a green half turn plus a translation, and a glide reflection where the glide is in the same translational component as the twists, and it's parallel to the line between them. So you have three generators. Two twofold twists or screw motions, parallel with the same translational component, glide reflection. Okay. How does the gluing look? Left to right is easy, that's glued by translation. Top to bottom is easy, it's glued just using this glide reflection. So you just take that to that. Front to back, you take from, so if you imagine you had a little tetrahedron here, the glide reflection will take it up here, and then the inverse of this twist would take it to there. So the front to back is glued by this times the inverse of that. Sure. All right, what's going on? The same game is how, the question is how could we possibly place this fundamental region into the cubical lattice so that it really gives us symmetries of the cubical lattice? That's what I said. And basically there are two ways of doing this. I'll only talk about one. So one sort of naturally makes sense. You just place it right along the cubical lattice so the rectangle prism has cubes in it lined up the normal way. The other one is that the axis, I'm going to use a bigger cube, can look like this. So you can have a rectangular prism cutting it where this is the up direction in your picture. That's up. You still have these twofold twists, and you still have glide reflections if this is your orientation. They're similar, but you have to retreat them separately. They're hard to unite in theory. Okay, and I'll just give you examples from the first case. So when it looks just like you should think, with cubes stacked in there in the normal way. Okay, and we play the same game. You project. It's starting to play. Animate. You project, and you're looking at where can you place the generators. So the generators were a glide reflection and two twists. And up to duality, there are 12 different ways of placing these guys. Basically, you place the twists at centers of edges, centers of faces, vertices, and so on. But from there, all of them, you can determine what's going on by three parameters. Three parameters. One is the height, just like before. You need to know how big the fundamental region is. One, you need to know how far apart the twists are. And then you just need to know how far away they are from the glide reflection. And from these three parameters, you can figure out all 12 of those cases. And also from these three parameters, you can basically determine the symmetries. And you have to trust me again. We have now 192 times K times A times D flags in our twistoid in the quotient. And let's look at symmetries of them. And this is where things start to get fun, because we're not orientable. As before, you still have these translations up. So now, because the twists are twofold twists, you get to go up 2k times, and those 2k translations will induce 2k automorphisms of your twistoid. So that cuts the flag orbits down by 2k. All right. Also, it's possible that you might have a translation of the lattice which shifts red to green. That's sort of, you can believe you might be able to shift if they're the same, meaning that if they go either both through edges or both through centers of faces or something like that. So using translations from the automorphism group of the cubical lattice, you can divide the number of flags by 4k. And now the question is, what else might we have? What might not come from a translation of the cubical lattice? And because this is not orientable, it's interesting. So for example, if you look at the translation up by k, so the translation that takes you from the bottom of the fundamental region to the top, it's a translation, but it's also a reflection in this wall. It's also a half turn in this axis or a half turn in this axis. So you have translations which look nothing like translations, basically. So it becomes a little bit of a challenge to pin down what are the actual symmetries of this object, right? Something which is a translation, a reflection, and a half turn in our terminology is a little bit confusing. But you do have some new things. You have, this is good, the right slide. You do have two more things that you can prove are not translations. I mean, they're not induced by translations. One, which would be a half turn in the axis through the middle that way, and one through a half turn in the axis through the middle that way. And both of those things are always there. And from there, we take our number of flags down from 192 KAD to just 12 AD. Like before, it's still unbounded, depending on how far apart your generators are. The symmetries of the map and the projection don't get you too far. You still have a big number of orbits. And to conclude, just some small examples. You have basically the same degenerate, smallest example, one vertex, three edges, three squares, one cube. But the manifold is different. It's now on a unoriented manifold. Has three flag orbits instead of four like last case. And if you want a polytope, it's a nice looking one. K equals 2, the height is 2. The distance between everything is 1, which gives you a fundamental region that looks like this, made of 8 cubes, 8 vertices. Again, the smallest one has 12 flag orbits. And you can see, if you imagine there were 8 cubes inside of here, this is what it looks like. And